From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, what a Kennedy-Markey showdown means for Massachusetts. And looking into the public records from last month's so-called Operation Clean Sweep.
This police action doesn't necessarily fit in within the city's larger public health plan for how to deal with people in the opioid crisis.
Also, in advance of the Emmys, we ask, what makes good TV theme music?
The TV theme is going to be on every week. There's got to be new things to pick up the seventh time you listen to it. The 20th time, you should just be beginning to love it.
And
I remember certainly going to health fairs, and I'd see a table, and they might have suicide prevention materials on there. I would walk right past it, because I'd say, this doesn't apply to me.
We'll speak with the mother of one of the Columbine shooters. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with some big news that's shaking up the Massachusetts political world. WBUR has confirmed that Congressman Joe Kennedy III will announce this Saturday that he is going to challenge incumbent Senator Ed Markey in the Democratic primary. Markey was already facing two primary opponents, but Kennedy's decision to run pits two political powerhouses against each other. For more on what this means for the Commonwealth, we turn to WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. She joins us live from the nation's capital. Kimberly, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we know that Kennedy's been thinking about jumping into this race for at least a few months now. So that leads to the question, why right now?
Well, right now is a good time to try to keep the field as clear as possible. There are two other challengers in this race already, but he wants to be able to have the time to build up the type of support, to fundraise, and to get his message out, which seems so far to focus on structural changes. We've seen him propose things like term-limiting Supreme Court justices and eliminating the Electoral College. I think that's where he's going to go in his campaign to really push for his vision for why Massachusetts voters should elect him.
So those are big and very progressive structural changes, Kimberly. Is promoting that type of major system-wide reform a popular position even here in pretty liberal Massachusetts?
Well, Kennedy is banking on that, and he also needs things to campaign on because he is trying to defeat someone who has been in Massachusetts politics for more than four decades in Ed Markey, and also somebody who has a lot of support among progressives. Remember, Ed Markey is one of the authors of the Green New Deal, and that earned him the endorsement of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Green New Deal co-sponsor and a progressive hero. So that's going to be the question here. Who is the more progressive candidate? I think most people would say Markey, but Joe Kennedy is going to try to say, you know, a generational change is still necessary.
And that sets up an interesting tension. You know, Markey's 73, Kennedy's 38. Yes, there's a generational dimension, but we tend to equate more progressive with younger, but that may not be the case here.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Ed Markey is hoping is the case, and why he rolled out that endorsement from Ocasio-Cortez even before Kennedy announced. There's also a tension. I mean, this is going to put Massachusetts Democrats in a tough spot. They're going to have to choose. So far here on Capitol Hill, it seems that Ed Markey has the lion's share of the support. Both the progressives here on Capitol Hill, as well as more established Democrats, have been telling me today that they really don't understand why Joe Kennedy is running. On the flip side, the polling that we've seen so far, the Boston Globe Suffolk University poll, shows Kennedy way out ahead. So I think that answers the question.
So I know I might be getting ahead of myself, but regarding the 2020 race, Senator Elizabeth Warren is looking strong in the Democratic primary. If she were to become the nominee, then her seat would be open. Why would Kennedy not just wait and see how that plays out?
That's a very good question. And actually, some folks on Capitol Hill posed that question to Kennedy himself, suggesting that he should wait to see what happens in the presidential race. And maybe that's where he'll have his opening. The problem with that is that's a lot of ifs. If Senator Warren wins the nomination, if Senator Warren becomes president, and then this seat will open. There are so few opportunities in Massachusetts for politicians, especially young, ambitious ones, to move up. And putting all those ifs on it may seem like a much longer shot to Kennedy than running for a race that he knows is actually happening.
Okay, so Kimberly, very briefly, what will you be watching most closely now?
I'll watch what Kennedy says on Saturday, the pitch that he makes to voters and how he tries to distinguish himself from Ed Markey. And I'll watch Markey starting tonight. He's going to appear in Lawrence. He's going to really try to push his vision of progressivism and remind people that he is one of the founders of the climate change movement.
WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins from Washington, D.C. Kimberly, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We're continuing our coverage of a major Boston Police Department action from early last month, one the BPD has called Operation Clean Sweep. Over 2 days, August 1st and 2nd, the BPD arrested 34 people in the South End area of Melnia Cass Boulevard, Mass Ave, and Southampton Street. Initially, both Police Commissioner William Gross and Mayor Marty Walsh claimed that most of the arrests were for violent crimes and that most of the arrested individuals were from outside of Boston. But through a public records request and further digging, we found a much murkier picture of the police action. For more on this, we spoke with WBUR reporting fellow Jerome Campbell about exactly what he was able to piece together from the arrest records.
The report showed that 9 people were arrested for dealing drugs. Not all of them were selling drugs at the time of the arrests. 8 were arrested for drug possession, the drugs ranging from heroin, cocaine, and prescription narcotics. And 18 of the people were arrested solely on active warrants. One of those was for trespassing, and 3 others were for larceny.
All right, so 18 arrests solely on active warrants. That appears to contradict what we heard from BPD Commissioner Gross and Mayor Walsh about both the focus and the outcome of the arrests.
Yes, both of them said that most of the people were violent offenders who were preying on the community around the Southampton Street shelters and recovery centers. It wasn't the only detail that they got wrong. There was also 19 people who were from the greater Boston area. And half of the people who were arrested wrote down that they were living at a shelter or were homeless.
So the commissioner had originally argued, Jerome, that most of the people who were arrested were from out of town. You say 19 from greater Boston, but greater Boston isn't the city of Boston. Some of them could still have been from out of town, right? So can you kind of clarify that for us?
Yeah. So of the 34, 14 people were specifically from Boston neighborhoods.
Okay.
And then getting up to 19, 5 more people were from Dedham. We're talking Quincy, closer, you know, sort of the adjacent cities. And then the rest were from locations that were not. They were either somewhere else in the Commonwealth or I think in 2 cases they were from outside the state.
Jerome, did you get any insight into how police actually decided who to target or who to approach and who to arrest during their operation?
Well, the reports sort of break it down into 2 main categories. There was a smaller category where cases where police officers would see someone that they had recognized from a previous arrest and started paying attention to them and then had seen them conduct themselves in such a way that they were either conducting a crime or were leading police believe that a crime might have happened. But a majority of those cases, the report sort of detailed that they would see people sort of walk away from police cruisers or police officers and put something in their pocket. And based off of the training that they'd receive, at least this is what the police reports are telling us, that that officer said that was suspicious enough to sort of warrant a more intrusive investigation.
Some people would question treating walking away from a police officer as being suspicious activity. Were there strong grounds for the police? Or do we have other precedent for the police to treat something like, I'm walking away from you, as suspicious enough to approach you and potentially arrest you?
That's a good question. Well, the reports didn't detail anything about how that training was informed. So to be able to specifically answer that question, no. I think what the reports do say is that they have come to understand this area as an open-air drug market. So and they sort of refer to this expectation that in this area something, whether it's a drug deal or an assault or some sort of criminal activity happening, that is not surprising to them.
All right. So those arrested were arraigned in Roxbury District Court. And we know that Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins has said that her office doesn't think Suffolk County Corrections is the right place for people with addiction. She also, in general, does not want to prosecute certain low-level offenses. So has she commented on what we now know about the arrests?
Well, Rollins has said that she does not want to see these people in jail. And as part of it, 8 of the people who were arrested in these sweeps were released without bail. So they were released straight back out into the community and hopefully, based on what she has said, are getting the help from organizations, whether local organizations, state local organizations, or federal entities that can provide the support that they need.
Jerome, the arrests happened on the 1st and 2nd of August. So why did it take so long to get this information?
Well, it largely had to do because it was a two-pronged approach. The first was that we had filed a public records request with the police department. We get these reports about a week after these sweeps. And it took about 2.5 weeks to get them back. Unfortunately, they were heavily redacted from any sort of personal information that would have helped us connect these defendants' names with the reports. So we had to go and use a different technique, which was going to the courthouse and pulling all the records for all the defendants, which you can imagine is a very lengthy process. Unfortunately, those documents are not only just in one courthouse. They're in the Boston court. They're in Malden. They're in Chelsea. And because of it, it just took a while to get around, find all the reports, and then find the additional information to fact check what was provided by the police.
Jerome, in the immediate days after the arrests, we heard a lot of concern from activists about police methods and approach. Have you heard any reactions from activists to this new information that you've released?
Yeah, so many of the activists are saying that, I guess what my piece showed is the same thing that they've been talking about, what they've known to be true for a while, which is that they're saying that when police are in the area around these shelters, around these recovery centers, they're looking to arrest people on warrants and not necessarily arresting people on these new crimes that are happening all the time in this area.
And then, of course, again, you found that 18 of the arrests were, in fact, on warrants.
Yes.
All right. Any unanswered questions left?
So there's two questions. First, where are the people who were arrested in these sweeps? We know 8 of them were released without bail, but we're not sure if they have returned back to these shelters and recovery centers where many of them were prior to these sweeps. And the second question is, this police action doesn't necessarily fit in within the city's larger public health plan for how to deal with people in the opioid crisis. And so hearing from the mayor and the police commissioner about sort of how does this sweep fit in, I think would help detail a lot.
That from WBUR reporting fellow Jerome Campbell. And WBUR reached out to both Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and Police Commissioner William Gross, but they declined to comment. So to discuss this further, we turn now to Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George. She's the chair of the Council's Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery. Councilor Asaibi-George, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Tiziana. Good to talk to you.
You too. So we spoke with you shortly after the police action originally happened, and at that time you said you had concerns. Mayor Walsh and Commissioner Gross were quite forceful in saying this operation was targeted at violent offenders, drug dealers, and people preying on the sick and suffering. Now, hearing these new arrest details, do you feel misled by that?
Well, I don't actually feel so misled, because we do know that many people who are sick and suffering are also participating in some of this drug dealing activity. And we do know a number of individuals are unfortunately looking to feed their own addiction, feed their own habit if they're dealing with a substance use disorder with dealing. But it's so important in this work around helping those that are suffering from this, from addiction, suffering from this crisis, that they get the services that they need to be well. And unfortunately, if you are dealing drugs, that there is, along with assistance and hopefully a pathway to recovery, there unfortunately is also some punishment that unfortunately comes along with that.
So you talked about just now and last time we spoke with you, the importance of people who are experiencing addiction mm-hmm. getting treatment. Some of the people arrested, that really was the situation. They were using their own addiction. It's been over a month now. Are people getting treatment? And as a result of this police action, are you hearing that people are staying away from that area? What do we know about that?
Well, over the last few weeks, I've spent some time in the Mass and Cass area, and we have seen a shift in where many of these individuals are unfortunately staying on the street. There has been sort of a redistribution in that area and throughout our city. And I think it's more important than ever that we as a city, especially those that are providing the direct services, the direct care, are looking at this as a regional approach. We need to look at the area as a whole. We can think about the Mass and Cass area in particular, but really the Boston area, there are people that are dealing with this crisis day in and day out. And, you know, we have this Operation Clean Sweep. There, unfortunately, in my view and in my opinion, there wasn't a continuum of care as a part of that effort. And people are not getting the care that they need. And we need to make sure that those that were released, that were arrested, that they, you know, and where I understand the question, appreciate the question, where are these people now? I want to make sure that they're getting the services they need.
Let's pick
and
up.
And getting those. Go ahead.
Well, let's pick up on that for a second. Our reporter, Jerome Campbell, had raised the question of how this particular police approach fit into the larger city public health strategy. What do you think about that? How do these things fit together?
Well, I think that we have seen a real need for better communication among our city's agencies. And this one particular effort that was undertaken by Boston Police needed to be better coordinated with our public health approach, because it's nobody here operates in a vacuum, that these silos need to be broken down. And our police are working with limited resources. Our health department and our outreach teams are working with limited resources. We need to make sure that they can better coordinate services. But really, in the end, for most of these individuals that are on the street dealing with this, with substance use disorders, dealing and facing homelessness, we need a public health approach to that work, not a police approach. That being said, there are individuals, and Jerome mentioned those individuals in his piece, that were arrested on drug charges. That has to be taken seriously, because as we do the work around getting care to people who need care and treatment, we need to realize that there is a drug trade and there is drug dealing that exists in our city that we need to put a halt to.
Counselor, we spoke earlier with Paul Bowman. He's the Massachusetts chapter director of the National Alliance for Medication-Assisted Recovery. He's in recovery himself. And he says he thinks police were deliberately targeting homeless people and drug users.
Most of the people out there are just struggling to get from one day to the next and waiting on housing lists and struggling with their own, you know, substance use disorders.
So just briefly, what do you say to the argument that police sweeps like these criminalize addiction and poverty and homelessness?
We have to move away from criminalizing poverty for sure, and addiction certainly, as well as homelessness. And all individuals in that area, or almost all of those individuals in that area, are experiencing homelessness. And it's so important that we're getting them the resources that they need. But we also need to protect them from the vulnerabilities that they're experiencing because they're on the street, because they're dealing with substance use disorders, because they're in the midst of this crisis. It is about protecting that individual as well as the community at large.
Boston City Councilor Anissa Saibi-George, I really appreciate you coming back to Radio Boston today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Stay with us. Coming up, a new documentary explores the lessons America still needs to learn 20 years after the Columbine shooting. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 20 years ago, on April 20th, 1999, was the Columbine High School massacre, carried out by two high school seniors, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. 13 people were killed that day. Harris and Klebold died by suicide while at the school. Columbine was really the beginning of a rapid rise in school shootings, and there were many questions after the massacre, some of which fell on the parents of the shooters.
They're in the garage making these things. Where the hell were their parents?
How do you have a 15-year-old son in your basement making bombs, dressed in black trench coats, part of this subculture, and not know it?
A new documentary, American Tragedy, which premieres at the Boston Film Festival tonight, tries to answer those questions. It profiles Sue Klebold, Dylan's mother, before and after the Columbine massacre. And Sue Klebold joins me now on the phone from Colorado. Sue, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Also with me in studio is Boston-based film director Josh Sabe. American Tragedy was produced by Parents to Parents, a nonprofit focused on mental health. Josh, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks.
This is a difficult subject, but I wanted to kind of jump right in. Josh, as you prepared to make this film, tell us about getting to know Sue. What did you expect from or about her as you began?
You know, I think Andrew Solomon experienced a similar thing. He talks about this, where you go in, maybe you have some expectations that you're going to, you know, have some insight maybe into what happened, why Dylan participated in this, see maybe some problems. But that's definitely not the experience you have meeting Sue. She's wonderful. She's classy. She's kind. So she's a lovely, wonderful person to get to meet, and it was a privilege to get to know her.
Sue, we really appreciate you speaking with us. We heard a montage of the news coverage during shortly after the time of Columbine. It's questioning. It's accusing you for not knowing what your son was doing. You say in the film, when reflecting on tragedy, that we need to blame after an incident like this. In those early months, who or what did you blame?
In those early months, I was so bewildered and so heartbroken, I didn't really have any blame because I was simply trying to understand what had happened, how my son came to be there, because I was in a lot of denial about his being there, because the Dylan that I knew and loved would not do something like this. And he was kind and he was funny. I wasn't experiencing blame. I was just experiencing heartbreak and humiliation and terror because of all the hatred being leveled against us.
Sue, you talk in the film about the fact that about 6 months later, you learn the results of the police investigation, and it debunks or challenges this narrative you've been telling yourself in your head.
Yes. At about 6 months after the tragedy, the sheriff's department released a report. And I remember when I went to this report, I had a notebook with me, and it had all these questions about, how did Dylan get to be there? Who convinced him to do this? And what I learned from that shocking report was that this had been planned, that he had been a willing participant, that their goal was to kill everyone in the school. And I just remember at that meeting being almost physically ill. I remember at one point standing up and trying to decide if I needed to run out of the room or not. It was really put me into a flight mode. I just could hardly bear what I was hearing. So it was a shock, and it really caused me to tear down everything I'd been clinging to and really start the grief process all over, because people had been calling my son a monster. And for the first time, I think I really understood just how monstrous it was.
I want to play a cut from the film from Liza Long. She's a mother and an author who had a viral post about behavior she was worried about in her own son after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. Here she reflects on Columbine.
Whatever lessons we should have learned from Columbine, I would say unfortunately we did not. And that's why we keep repeating this very uniquely American tragedy.
Sue, you have remarkably and bravely gone through a process of reflecting in the years since. What lessons did we learn, or should we have learned, from Columbine?
I think over 20 years, there are probably more lessons than I can count. One of the very important lessons I hope we have learned, or that we are beginning to learn, after the Columbine tragedy, it was the beginning of 24/7 news coverage. without knowing it, that launched, kind of cemented Columbine in our consciousness as a symbolic gesture, perhaps, of, you know, good and evil. And really, this is not the case when something like this happens. It is about many things that converge. And certainly I have learned over the years that to understand how a tragedy such as this happens, we can never say it's because of one thing. It is not because of bullying, of video games, of psychiatric medications. It's never one thing. We don't have to be able to predict who is going to commit some kind of a violent act, but we can certainly prevent. For example, we have learned that school shooters very often are suicidal, and my own son, I learned after his death, had been suicidal and was writing about it. And if we could have addressed his suicidality, I truly believe that we might have prevented at least his involvement in the tragedy.
Can I comment
on
this?
In fact, I was going to ask you the same question, Josh. You had the opportunity to look deeply at the Columbine shooting, but with some perspective and distance. And what did you learn?
Yeah, so Dave Cullen, the author of Columbine, has also said that, you know, dealing with teenage depression is one of the great unlearned lessons of Columbine. And I think Sue's story is particularly interesting on this point because she was completely surprised. You know, she was as surprised as the rest of us. And, you know, she's, you know, gone through her past. You know, she talks about going through every possible interaction she remembers, you know, trying to find something. And, you know, she has discovered some things. She's, you know, discovered that her son was depressed. She didn't know that. She discovered that he was deeply suicidal. She didn't know that. And maybe what's so surprising is that there wasn't something obvious. There weren't these obvious signs that she should have spotted. And so the question of the documentary becomes, how do you stop something that's so invisible so often?
Well, let's talk about that invisibility for a minute, too. Here is Sue in the film reflecting on the fact she didn't think her son could be suicidal.
I remember certainly going to health fairs, and I would see a table, and they might have suicide prevention materials on there. I would walk right past it because I'd say, this doesn't apply to me. No one I love would ever die by suicide because I love them too much and I wouldn't let that happen. I see now that many other people do that too.
As somebody who viewed the film, it was really striking that it truly became about mental health, mental well-being, depression, suicide prevention. When were the moments where you came to understand that that was what this experience was truly about?
I think we came into it interested about this topic. I don't think we knew the answers we would get. Lots of people are scared that their child might be a school shooter. You know, that's a very small possibility. And it's even a small possibility that your kids will be in a school shooting. But it's a very large possibility that they'll deal with something like depression or anxiety. These are things we actually can do things about, and we can often prevent if we start early enough. Right now, all of our resources are going into treatment. We have a treatment-focused model. So someone, you know, might develop almost invisibly, like Dylan, a mental illness, and we don't even start treating it until it's entrenched. But if we start beforehand, if we start teaching mental health skills, we can have a much better outcome. We can have targeted campaigns that teach parents how to teach skills, you know, to deal with anxiety, you know, breathing skills, mindfulness skills, skills that can make a huge difference in their life and are proven to prevent anxiety and depression in our children.
Sue, is it fair to call you a mental health advocate? And if it is, when do you think you became one?
Oh, I suppose it's fair. My own path of discovery, when I learned that Dylan had written in a journal 2 years prior to his death, that he was in agony and wanted to die and was cutting himself. And I was so shocked to hear that, and I couldn't believe that while I was experiencing what seemed like a normal and fulfilling life, he was suffering so greatly. What we have to be careful of is that not everyone who experiences depression is suicidal, and not everyone who is suicidal is depressed. It is far more complicated than that. And so we want to be careful before we even start this discussion that becoming a mental health advocate, I sort of put that in air quotes because I use the term in my book of being a brain health advocate or being a mental wellness advocate, because we don't yet know enough about these boundaries that get crossed when someone is on a path towards self-destruction. So we must be very careful about pinning all the blame on mental illness when we talk about tragedies such as this.
Both of you have talked about this is a rare circumstance. And Sue, you've thoughtfully pointed out that there is not a direct overlap between what we would traditionally refer to as mental illness and the tendency to be violent or to commit acts like this. At the same time, mental wellness talks about the responsibilities early on to help children learn healthy mental health habits, et cetera. There was a piece of me that thought in watching it, in some ways, doesn't that also put staggering pressure on parents, especially when one of the points you make over and over again in the documentary is how much parents may not know what their young people are experiencing?
Well, see, I would hope it does the opposite, because I think it's much more stressful to be sitting as a parent wondering, I hope I love my kids enough. I hope I'm being a good parent in this abstract, you know, idea, and they're going to avoid all of these problems. It's much more reassuring to feel empowered with things that are proven to help kids avoid common problems like depression, like anxiety, and to know that there are things that can be taught.
This film deals with mental well-being, but it doesn't go in-depth on guns. Josh, why not?
We do mention it, that we should address it. It's not the angle, it's not the approach that we're talking about in this documentary. And I think what's a tragedy is that these issues have been split up as either or instead of both and, particularly because they actually inform and speak to each other. You know, by far the most number of gun-related deaths are suicide. And so if we're going to prevent deaths, you know, gun-related deaths, we should be thinking about the mental health aspects of it. And so these issues are interrelated, they're connected, and politically they've been separated, and that's really too bad.
All right, so for both of you, the film is going to premiere. A lot of people are going to see this. What would your message to families be today?
I believe that the message that I have taken away from this and that I share with people is, and that is the subtitle of the movie, and that is, love is not enough. I think we believe when we hug our children and tell them we love them, that we are connecting with them. But I hope people will realize that someone's internal experience on the receiving end of that love might be very different from what we are thinking it should be and what we project it to be.
And Josh Shabee, what's the message you want people to take away from American Tragedy?
One is to drop the simple answers, have empathy for people like Sue, and ultimately an empowerment and hope. That for our own kids, there's hope there. We can dramatically decrease depression, suicidality, a lot of these issues, and that would be a huge benefit to society. And it's just so much more personal than that. You know, talking about a society, it feels abstract, but just in general, like you have children.
Yep.
And I can I ask the question back to you? What was your takeaway?
My takeaway from the documentary was, deeply check in with and engage with your kids and help them deal with the emotional aspect of their lives the same way I support them in dealing with homework and their physical health and the other parts of their lives.
Yeah, I think there's a great line that Sue says in the documentary where she says she taught Dylan, you know, dental hygiene. She taught him financial responsibility. But she didn't even know really that she should be teaching brain health or be aware of that or teaching him how to notice his emotions. You know, that wasn't even part of her, you know, her paradigm. And that's been one of her I think that's her biggest regret.
And I advise people all the time, stop talking and just allow our loved ones to feel what they feel, express what they are feeling, and help them deal with those feelings. And I don't think most of us do a very good job of that.
That's mother and advocate Sue Klebold. Sue, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And Boston-based film director Josh Sabee. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks.
Listeners, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. or you can text the crisis text line at 741-741. American Tragedy will premiere at the Boston Film Festival tonight at 7. More information is on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Emmys are this Sunday, but one show has already received an award for the best theme music on TV. That is the opening theme for the HBO comedy drama Succession, composed by Nicholas Britell. The score won for Outstanding Original Main Title Theme Music at the Creative Arts Emmy Ceremony. That's a preliminary event honoring achievement in technical and artistic categories. Mason Daring is a feature film composer and a film scoring professor at Berklee College of Music. We spoke with him this week about TV themes. He started by talking about what makes the one for Succession so good.
Talent, class, melody.
Tell me what you mean by class.
Oh, boy, it's highbrow. There are, in fact, some nominees aren't very classy, and we're going to hear one or two of them today, I think, but that doesn't mean they're not appropriate. But this is a show heavily scripted with Brian Cox chewing up the scenery all over the place, and they wanted a full-bore theme, and they got one. Nicholas Britell is a great composer. He does a lot of features. Generally, feature composers are brought in to do the main title theme. They sometimes do the rest of the music for the series, but not always.
Do you think Succession should have won?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Well, so there we go. What makes a good TV theme?
Well, to paraphrase The Boss, there are 57,000 channels and a lot on. And the difference between feature films and TV themes is in feature films, you bought your ticket, you sat down, you're not going anywhere. In TV themes, that remote is real close by.
Yeah, you can just... Bzz, bzz, bzz.
You can just change it. So the TV theme has to say more than one thing. It's got to say, this is what the show is about. But more importantly, it's got to say, you're in great hands. We are really good at our job. Listen to how great this music is, because the writing and the acting and the principal photography are just as good. It makes you feel comfortable. You can sit back and enjoy the show.
What goes into composing a great TV theme?
First of all, a meeting with the producers, and they tell you what it's about. You'll, of course, watch the pilot, maybe a couple of other episodes. But generally, you want to go back and forth with them. You want to get their input. You want to play them an initial melody, an initial arrangement, and have them comment on it. It's a synergistic job. It requires the input of the producers as well as the composer.
So here's one that you composed yourself alongside Martin Brody. This is the theme for Frontline, PBS. So was that collaborative? What went into creating that?
Oh, we worked with David Fanning, the executive producer who started and ran that show for 30-some years. We worked with David and his crew for weeks, actually, because it was the very beginning. We didn't know the show was going to run for 30-some years. And I didn't know the music.
You didn't know it had to be that durable.
I didn't know it had to be that good. But Marty Brody is a fantastic composer. And we had so much fun and so much support. A lot of it has to do with the spirit that's in the air of the people running the show. And especially when it's a new show, it's full of energy and vigor.
I can hear kind of the horns in that are aspirational. There's something aspirational to that music.
Thank you. It really does still sound okay to me 34 years later. I can't believe it's still on the air now that I think about it. But I still like listening to it.
Yeah, that's great. So, okay, you teach film scoring. Do you teach your students to do something different when they're looking at scoring for TV than film?
Yes. First of all, the speakers are smaller than your hand. When you're in a movie theater, the speakers are bigger than your body.
Good point.
So it's a different listening environment. The screen is smaller, but most people, when they hear a movie and watch a movie, they're going to watch it once. They may someday see it again. But a TV theme is going to be on every week, and maybe for 34 years. And that means it's got to be durable. There's got to be new things to pick up the seventh time you listen to it. The 20th time, you should just be beginning to love it. And after 34 years, you really ought to dig it. because you don't want them to change it. It has happened, by the way, where the same composer has changed this theme.
Wasn't that true with The West Wing?
Yes, exactly. Snuffy Waldron, he rewrote the arrangement for it and recorded it. They didn't know it was going to be that popular. And when it became insanely popular, I believe they left and they gave him a bigger budget.
So I've got, like, my hands up in the air.
Me
this
too.
This is not the original.
Did that make you feel great?
It does.
Yeah, it sure does.
So tell me, is it my love of the show that I'm feeling right this minute, or is it the love of the music that
yes,
I'm feeling?
Yes, that's the answer. It's both of them, because it's such a great theme. It is the show.
Yeah.
You can see those actors. You can remember great moments from the show, and it was, of course, a fantastic show. But that you couldn't beat that theme.
No, I mean, it was sweeping. It was ambitious. It was majestic. Classy, right? Am I getting
it? Yes, it is. Sheer class. Snuffy did a great job.
So how have TV themes changed over time?
It's changed in terms of arrangement and instrumentation, because so many things now are electronic, and those were impossible to do 50 years ago. I mean, the first one was Outer Limits or Twilight Zone. There were elements of synthesis and early synthesis in that.
Let's listen to the Twilight Zone for a second,
sure,
because I want to draw out what you're saying. Let's listen to that. Okay, so you're shaking your head
with pleasure. Oh, it's one of the greatest
okay,
ever.
Okay, so what makes it so great?
Well, you can use it as a ringtone. Many of my friends do. And it puts you right back in that time. It makes you laugh, and yet it's dissonant. It's high in terms of musical composition. It's highly dissonant. And that's okay, because Twilight Zone was a pretty dissonant show.
It was. I mean, it seemed like it was made to make one feel uncomfortable, and that music is not comfortable either. But,
a gremlin pulling off the engines of a wing, as William Shatner sat there and looked at it, was a pretty uncomfortable moment in Twilight Zone, as I recall.
Yes, that's right.
And
you're saying that at the time it was a little cutting edge. There was something electronic going on there.
Yes. No one had ever done anything like that for an opening scene. We were, you know, about then, we were used to Gilligan's Island and you know, Love Boat, which came later, which were very palatable, inoffensive.
Love Boat.
Go ahead.
I can't resist.
Take it. That was appropriate too. Listen, Love Boat theme was tremendously appropriate for that show. If there's one word we're looking for, is it appropriate?
Is it appropriate?
Is it married to the show, and should it be?
So it's so interesting because, of course, that's not, I would never think of it that way, but if I think of something like Cheers, right?
Oh.
It did feel appropriate.
What a great song, right?
So, Cheers made me think of something. Okay, so let me backtrack for a second. I was listening to the nominees for this year, all right? And one of them is for a song for the show Our Planet. Let's listen.
How did we get here? There was so much love in us. And all I have left is my faith that I can change. I can't watch this burn, I can't watch this burn to the ground. You'd have thought we'd learned, you'd have thought we'd learned by now.
All right, so I should start just by saying you gave a thumbs up as soon as we started playing that music. Are you a fan of that one?
Oh, I am. Oh, first of all, she's got pipes to burn.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it's a beautifully written and produced song, and it's about the planet. I wouldn't touch the dial. I would say that's it. This is what I want to watch. You're in good hands. This is going to be a terrific show, and it's going to be about the difference, you know, the relationship between humans and our planet. That's crystal clear from 30 seconds in on that song.
Well, it's one of you just brought out one of the reasons that I wanted to play it. And in a second, I want to play a little bit more from the part of the Cheers theme that we never hear. Because this, Our Planet theme, this is a social message song, right? And when I heard that, it really struck me that we've gotten to a point where our TV themes can have social messages. If you listen, one of our producers pointed this out, if you listen to the part of the Cheers theme we don't usually hear, you get a very different kind of message.
Roll out of bed, Mr. Coffee's dead. The morning's looking bright.
Morning's looking bright.
And your shrink ran off to Europe and didn't even write.
your husband wants to be a girl. Be glad there's one place in the world where everybody knows your name.
Okay, so that...
Never heard it.
Right, you didn't.
Whatever happened to everybody knows your name.
Right, and it's certainly not a positive social message,
no,
right? It's not a song that would even get picked today. So are we doing something different in our programming and our music now that we're incorporating social messages in a way we wouldn't have back when we were doing Welcome Back, Kotter?
Yes, you're absolutely right. We have permission from our culture to do this with our music. No wonder they buried that lyric back in the day of Cheers. They didn't want to confront that.
No.
Now it's fine. Bring it on because we're ready to look at ourselves.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, too. Let's talk about looking at ourselves. One of the other things that we noticed as we were thinking about television theme songs is that this year and in the past years, the show's nominees have been largely white. The songs have been largely from sort of a white composition tradition, and they've been from white shows. So no Empire, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Cosby Show. And in fact, Cosby had several versions of the same song.
Yes,
it was part of what was innovative about
it.
Now, I understand that Bill Cosby is complicated, but that show wasn't, and its music wasn't.
That's right.
So what's going on there, and why have we missed some of the richer traditions in what we celebrate in television themes?
Sometimes we want to be comfortable, we want to be self-assured, we want to be safe. And sometimes they pick people as composers or they pick shows to run that they feel are safe. We all hope we get to a point where we don't know or care what the ethnicity of the composer is or the musicians. Part of it probably relates to who's in the Emmy Academy now, but that will change, and as the membership changes, and certainly they're trying to change the membership of that the same way that the Motion Picture Academy has been changing, and that will result in different types of nominations, I guarantee it. Also, there will be more diversity in programming. It's coming. It has to. There'll be more Spanish-speaking. Why don't we assume
excellent
a Spanish-speaking
point.
Theme show can win, or never mind be nominated?
Excellent point.
It can be. And you know what? It will be. I hope I'm around for it.
All right, so we've talked a lot about what makes a good theme for a television show. So let's have a little fun and talk about what a bad one sounds like. One example you've given is from one of those television police shows. This one was T.J. Hooker. Action-packed. Why is it bad?
Oh, let me count the ways. Is that Mike Post? I can't remember.
I don't know.
We all have off days.
I don't remember who played T.J. Hooker. I think
William
it was
Shatner.
So what about police shows? What about quality of show and what comes through in the music?
You've got to pick a composer that has enough talent, but more importantly, really wants to hit it out of the park because he wants to make the producers happy. I tell my students, I say, listen, when you do a movie, it's not a two-hour music video with regrettable dialogue. You know? It's a movie, and it's our job to make it better.
All right. Any theme that we haven't talked about that you think you want to call to mind?
Downton Abbey. Why? Because it's a terrific orchestral theme. It puts you right in England at the beginning of the 20th century, and yet it had a timeless quality to it. You could bet it's going to be the opening theme in the movie. There's no two ways about that. It's a beautiful theme. I never knew who that composer was. I don't know where he came from, but I know why I got the job, because he got the job done.
You know, when I was a kid, if you went somewhere and you started to sing the Brady Bunch song, everyone could sing it with you. You know, today I guess we don't have that as much because so much of our theme music now doesn't have words that it's hard for people to sing it. But if somebody started to sing the Game of Thrones music, other people would join in. So is there something about the shared experience of television themes that, am I being too ambitious to say, unites us or brings us together or gives us a shared cultural marker?
Oh, no. Remember, there's a great scene from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with John Candy and Steve Martin where they're on a bus and Steve Martin wants everybody to sing Christmas carols. And he starts it and nobody knows him. And then John Candy goes, how about the theme from Gilligan's Island? And they all yells, rage in. It's a fabulous moment.
I had forgotten about that.
It's a fabulous
scene.
Moment. And that united everybody on that bus. It frankly united everybody in every movie theater in America that saw that particular scene, because it made you feel great about your childhood, about your culture, and frankly about being an American.
So what's coming next? What do we expect from the evolving world of TV themes and how music is changing, how the technology of how we produce music is changing?
I you know, it's funny. It's a war between classical elements of orchestral themes like Succession and melodic themes and the edgy, inorganic, synthetic themes that seem to creep us out and work in their own way. And I don't mind that symbiosis. I don't mind that conflict between old and new. It's never going to go away. I mean, it might as well be generational in television.
That was Mason Daring, feature film composer and a film scoring professor at Berklee College of Music. We spoke to him this week about TV themes. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.